Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I am Ann Clark, a member of the club representing the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum. I will be your chair for this evening's program, The Leading Edge for Corporate Responsibility. It is my great pleasure to introduce our moderator, Bob Saldovich, who is a member and former chair of the Governing Board of the Commonwealth Club of California. And Bob will introduce you to our program and to our speaker tonight.
Hi. Just want to make sure everybody's awake here. Pamela, sitting on my left, when she was 12 years old, she witnessed extreme poverty in Mexico. She started on a remarkable path of social entrepreneurship. And I've known Pam for a long time, so I've watched her develop and grow and become really one of the leaders of social entrepreneurship in the world. It's quite remarkable. She's worked in remote villages in India, crisis relief work in El Salvador, earthquake, in the killing fields of Cambodia, and the list goes on and on. She was the founder of Volunteer Match, a remarkable organization, which was devoted to linking up individuals with needs, individuals with money, with individual with needs, and solving their problems, or trying to, in the U.S. This is a successful nonprofit which has matched more than 2 million volunteers with domestic nonprofit of their choice. She later launched Volunteer Match Corporate, a similar version for corporations and their volunteer programs. She is now the CEO and founder of Universal Giving, a social entrepreneurship nonprofit which matches donors and volunteers with quality international organizations. So she's really been around the horn. She also has a political science degree from Duke, cum laude. She's a guest lecturer at the USC School of Business. We could go on and on. I'll close with a comment that she has been invited to the White House for a recent Next Generation Leaders Conference. She promised to tell us all about what happened there. I've known Pam for a remarkable number of years and take great pleasure in introducing her to you tonight. Pam Hawley.
Thank you very much, and I'm very grateful. When I first started some of my ventures, I met with Mr. Saldick, and you know, a lot of entrepreneurs get a lot of no's, and I remember standing in the driveway of his home and him saying, "You're going to do it, kid. I know you're going to do it." And it's now been about 15 years that we've known each other, and he's been very supportive of me in launching these ventures. I think we're reaching a new age right now, very, very thrilling about what's happening in corporate social responsibility. When I first started in this realm, it was very much of a feel-good. It was very optional. You were lucky if a CEO was kind of championed it and wanted to do it. And now we're seeing, even from peer pressure, that companies are doing it because they feel like they have to, which is a good thing because we want to get them practicing it and getting that into their bloodstream. And with some of the CEOs that we work with, some who might be a little bit more reluctant at first, it's very hard when you're giving and volunteering on the ground to not let your heart start to get engaged with this. Or, you know, you might go because you think you need to or you should. But once they see the effect of affecting other people, people get converted about the importance of corporate social responsibility. And it is very, very important with CSR that we are both helping companies with their bottom line. We do need to help them with their business objectives and helping the community. And I think that's the big shift that I've seen over probably the past 15 years, is that we really do need to look at the company's bottom line when we look at what corporate social responsibility is. So I think that's a little bit of our overview there. And as far as the White House, we were one of 50 leaders brought back there to work on issues of social innovation and work with the Office of Public Engagement. Really stellar individuals who are trying to really make a difference, already have made a difference, and are making some very, very strong collaborations with support from the White House. And it's very, very exciting. It's the first time that the White House has ever convened a group of next-generation leaders. So the nice thing is we have met. The collaborations are continuing, and it's very active. It's not a one-off event. So I'm very thrilled that we're seeing that kind of movement as well.
We're going to have sort of open questions. We have a mic for those of you who are inclined to ask a question. Just raise, somehow get a hold of this mic, and we'll put the on button on. That's helpful. And we'll pass it around to you. So let me start out with a couple of questions. Pamela, first of all, I don't remember saying, "You can do it, girl," but I hope I did. Tell us how it really works. How does a volunteer or a volunteer organization get connected to a group of people who need money and who need resources? How do you make that happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's pretty incredible when you look at it now across the world. You've got 1 billion NGOs or nonprofits across the world, 1 billion. So they've got a lot of resources. I mean, many of them don't have to create websites now. They can go to online platforms. They can register themselves and be able to recruit donors and volunteers by registering themselves. Having said that, there's challenges to doing so because there's cultural barriers, there's language barriers. Often other countries have more difficulties or more challenges in creating their own websites, so they have to go to U.S.-based websites first. And that might not be that easy, or culturally or language-wise might be difficult. But I think there's a lot of online resources that can allow the nonprofits to take advantage of that at this time. With Volunteer Match, it was strictly volunteers and was domestic. And at that time, when we were launching it in 96, it took me about 3.4 faxes to fax the nonprofits to get them to sign up. There were no emails held by nonprofits. It was the person who had a dial-up connection at home who would painstakingly register the nonprofit from home. So you didn't have emails for Red Cross or for these other organizations. It was someone who wanted to do it from home. So now it's obviously a lot easier. With Universal Giving, our website is a marketplace where it allows you to come in. You can search by country or by an issue area such as the environment or such as education, and it comes back with a list of vetted projects. And so it's, I think what happens now is you can come in and you can donate $25 to help feed a family in Sudan, or you can help spend $15 to help clean up the Amazon River, or you can go volunteer to help clean up the Amazon River. But the key change I've seen for nonprofits is that you really have to look at quality. So in Universal Giving, we do not accept all nonprofits on our site, which is a radical change from Volunteer Match for me. With Universal Giving, we have to go with quality, because what I saw on the ground was absolute amazing leaders who are absolutely incredibly doing such profound work to help women and women's rights, humans' rights, the environment, and we also saw a lot of fraud. So when you're dealing with international, you've got to bring that personal story home, and you've also got to bring trust. So trust is absolutely paramount. It's one of our values at Universal Giving, and in working with the companies, it's critical as well. So I think it's a new age for nonprofits when they're registering on the sites. They've got to have a lot more quality control. And the companies that we work with are also looking for that.
Pamela, we've had a request from the folks in the back of the room, not for me to stand up at the podium so that they can see me, but for you to stand up at the podium so they can see you. Is that right? Yes. While you're there, corruption. Corruption is what you keep hearing about as a problem for nonprofits. Get suckered in into the things that seem perfectly normal and perfectly supportable, and then they find out that the folks who they're giving the money to was not spending it where they are supposed to. How do you monitor that? How do you control that? How do you not have that problem?
I think we are seeing a lot of different sites out there that focus on quality, which is good. But in the past, the way we've looked at quality is very much by overhead, by financials. It's very much by objective review of the organizations. And we actually don't believe that that's enough. So that's one part that's important, to look at the overhead of the nonprofit, or to look at their financial statements, or to look at their past track record. But when you look at what venture capitalists do, they look at a project or they look at a business model and they want to see that it's successful. And then the next thing they do is they ask, who is the management team? Who are the people who are leading the nonprofits? And that's a subjective review. That's a people review. That's a judgment review. And so when we look at quality, we're looking at, we have a quality model that we use in-house. That quality model, when I first started out, was 6 stages. It's now 15. And it goes over everything from financial vetting to overhead to Terrorist Act review to Patriot Act to leadership review, where we get to know the leaders. We're speaking with them on the phone. We're checking out their track record. We're finding out about their values. It is both subjective and objective. So, you know, the whole marketplace is moving more towards this quality, where quality cannot just be strictly from financials. It has to also be a subjective personal leadership review. And I think you find that a lot in life, that a lot of things that are quality have to come down to leadership and to people judgment. So we really, really look at that when we look at the nonprofits on our site. So for you coming to the site, you were able to get 100% of your donation goes directly to the project. We don't charge you for the donation. But when we work with companies, we do charge them for vetting, because they are spending a fair amount of money to go and make sure that these nonprofits are right. And that's part of the service that we provide in corporate social responsibility for companies, is that we go in and we consult with them on their CSR strategies, how to expand them internationally. And also we vet the NGOs for them. And that is a critical part for companies as they move forward in this day and age. Doing good, or trying to do good, can come with a lot of challenges. And one needs to be extremely aware of that and make sure that you set those precautions in place. Otherwise, it can really hinder your efforts, and it can become a PR debacle for a company. So that's one of the main reasons how we help companies.
Question? Hey, why don't you use this microphone? We want to record it for radio,
Okay.
That's why.
How big does an NGO have to be before you will vet them?
The size doesn't matter. It's the quality. So it could be very big. It could be very small. I've grown up being an entrepreneur. I started my first quote-unquote business when I was 10, out of my room in my home. And I appreciated my father's support in buying my little products that I made. So we look at small nonprofits, and we very much cherish what they do. That is not important. What's important is the quality. So sometimes you'll find a local on-the-ground leader, and companies will want to work with a small organization. In fact, we're working with a company right now. They're trying to set up an event that would be a volunteer event in Barcelona, and they need to facilitate 1,300 employees. We can either go with a large organization, or we can go with a lot of small ones. And the value of going with a lot of small ones is that you're getting local on-the-ground leaders who really know those needs. It's not a large organization coming in from outside who's maybe got an arm there on the ground in Barcelona. It is a lot of small organizations that know the local needs, have that local buy-in, and so we love working with local organizations. Now, there is a challenge to that in scaling. If, for example, with another one of our clients, you want to scale your services and you need to launch 30 different locales across the world, then sometimes it does make sense to work with a larger organization if you need that consistency. So we do work with both types of organizations depending on the different CSR strategies.
You mean you started when you were 10 and not 12? Is that? Jesus. What about Cisco? You usually talk about Cisco as a company in the Valley that has really embraced you guys, in a figure of speaking. So what about them? What do they do that singles them out from the run-of-the-mill company?
Cisco is quite an innovator. I would say they are always pushing the mark and not afraid to go and expand in different areas. I think one of the biggest trends we're seeing now with companies is that they have domestic programs in place. They're trying to expand them internationally, and they don't know how to do that. How do you provide consistency from headquarters with some objectives from headquarters that are consistent across the world, but then also provide local buy-in, local input by all the local employees? And so finding that balance is very important. Cisco does a really, really good job of that, of listening to the local employees, but also having some headquarter objectives. So they have about 40 what they call civic councils across the world. We go in and work with these civic councils. They're all employee-led, all volunteer-based. These employees are not getting paid to do it. And they're setting up giving and volunteer and product donation programs on the ground in 40 countries across the world. And so what they've done is they set up a whole intranet for this. They have a worldwide handbook that we've helped them with to help provide consistency as they scale across the world. And then they are constantly innovating on policy. So, for example, one of the key programs with companies is called matching gifts. Many of you who work at companies know that you can provide a donation and the company will match it. Well, what are one of the biggest prohibitors of a matching gift in a developing nation? Here, often, a company will match a gift if you give $25. But if you do that in an emerging nation, if you do that in India, $25 might be what someone earns in a year. So to have a matching gift policy and to just spread it and make it available internationally doesn't work. You've got to really tailor it according to what's happening in emerging nations. So they pioneered that, and they came back saying that it could be a much lower rate of $10, and it's gone even lower depending on different countries. So that's where you need to be an innovator, which is you scale. How do you provide that consistency from your headquarters, but then also tailor it to local areas so that people can take advantage of matching gifts and not be costed out from that? So they've been an innovator in many ways. I think also they understand the importance of quality. So they adopt our highest vetting model. We do 15 stages, and we constantly are updating the quality model to the extent that one of the latest innovations they've done is media vetting. We actually go in and check media sources to see how nonprofits are covered and how they speak in front of the media. Because we need to make sure that nonprofits, if they have a challenge with companies, are able to have a dialogue with companies. They aren't just speaking pejoratively about the company to the media. We also need to see how the media covers the nonprofits, because the company's brand is so important. So we vet nonprofits according to media standards for a company like Cisco. And not all companies take it to that level, but they are constantly setting trends about how to advance their quality. So I think that's a key distinction of Cisco. Not everyone will take it to that level of doing media vetting. But the other key that we've really solved for them that they appreciate is that when nonprofits sign up, when they sign up on the site, there are the language, the cultural barriers, and they will often, the nonprofits, need handholding. And we will go back and forth, sometimes taking a couple of months to get a nonprofit signed up on the site. So we took that pain point away from the companies. Their employees used to come and say, "Where's the nonprofit that I wanted to get a matching gift? How come they're not in the database?" The people in community relations were getting emails from the nonprofit saying, "It's hard for me to register." So we became that client service team. And we then handle all the NGO and nonprofit requests for Cisco, so they're shielded from that from a client service level. So I think, you know, what we do is we help them with a strategy. We help scale them worldwide across all their civic councils. We vet the NGOs. We upload the NGOs to the database. And then a whole other area is getting out and marketing on a local level, which is a totally different ballgame as well. How do you market internationally as well to make sure that people use the services?
Is that on? Is that turned on? Push the button up. It was.
Yes. Those are very good questions. I'll just repeat them for everyone. Do we operate domestically? And also, do we ever come across conflicts of interest between what the company's trying to achieve and what the nonprofits are striving to do on the ground as well? We do operate domestically. We have a stronger expertise on the international side, but we do have domestic opportunities as well, mostly configured off of what our clients and our customers are asking us for. So if they ask us for something domestically, we'll go source the nonprofit, we'll vet it, and then we'll get that listed in our site. As far as conflicts of interest, I think this is, I was telling Bob and Ann, I hope this question would come up, because I do think it's a very, very challenging area. What happens if you have a company that's going in and perhaps providing some challenges to the natural landscape if they're doing digging or drilling, and then maybe they do good as well? How do you balance that? Is that okay to come in and do drilling and to perhaps disrupt the environment in some ways, and then also in another way come in and do good and kind of make up for it? I think that's something that's very unique to each company and to each client that one would work with, whether it's Universal Giving or other organizations out there. I definitely think that those issues come up. The most proactive companies are doing this because they do know that it's the right thing. They want to solidify good relationships with all types of people on the ground. Could be politicos, could be business officials, could be tribes people. They want to get what's called a local license to operate. Someone asked me the other day and said, well, where can you get the certificate? And I said, it's not a certificate. It's a sense of buy-in. It's a sense of trust that you get from working in locally on the ground and showing your sincerity. And that's your goal, is to get those relationships where you can have a long-term presence there. Going and providing something destructive and then trying to make up for it in another way really doesn't work in most areas of life. There's going to probably be some challenges or riots or revolts or things of that nature when that occurs. So we try to avoid that at all costs. Having said that, there are companies that for PR reasons do need to go in and do good and to help communities, and we will help them with it. But where our preference is we have one company that I think is doing amazing work. They actually don't have offices on the ground, and they're going into the continent of Africa. And I think that is extremely admirable. It's a new trend because most companies where their employees are living and working. But the latest trend we just heard about 2 weeks ago is one company is going into the continent of Africa to go start giving and volunteering first before they set up operations to sell their product. Now, that is one of the most innovative things you can do because you're going to get the buy-in, you're going to get the local license to operate before you're even starting to sell your product, whereas most companies are already on the ground and then they're trying to do some type of giving or volunteering or product donation. And I want to just pause for a second here because we're talking right now about giving, about volunteering, about product donations. But keep in mind that corporate social responsibility is a much, much larger realm. It's about sustainability. It's about environmental reports. It can be about the culture within the company. It's not only about, you know, giving and volunteering. That's what we focus on. But corporate social responsibility is about being a good citizen in many, many different ways, which can be defined by companies in different ways. And if you're really doing it right as a company, there's four objectives you're really reaching. One, you are affecting a positive global brand. Number two, you really are helping to make sure that your workforce is happy and motivated and they want to be a part of what you're doing so they feel good about working for your company. We definitely see this with the Y generation. They want to be with companies that are doing good and they demand that. The third is client attraction. They want to know that they can attract new clients by this good work that they're doing. And then the fourth, where possible, is we want to be able to help companies with their product adoption. So eventually, as you get that buy-in and you're on the ground, eventually that name recognition increases to a level whereby people are purchasing the products because they feel good about the company. And we can't always do that, but we strive to do that, and that is a long-term objective. So, yes.
Could you stand up so we can hear you better?
You've heard of the GATE initiative. So what do you think about some of the criticism that's out there now? For example, I saw an article today about how some of the billionaires are coming out and saying that these philanthropists are playing too much of a role in helping the needy, things that the state should be doing. To the extent, you could argue that you know, why should the corporations of the world be doing work on the ground in communities and setting up a market for themselves, which is kind of what you were just speaking about now? To what extent will that hinder, you know, state help, whether it's welfare here in the United States or help from the international community, from organizations like the World Bank and the IMF doing work on the ground in those countries, and to what extent are corporations having too much power in deciding who's helped and who isn't helped? So,
That's a good question. So I think just for people at the beginning of the question, you know, what about the criticism that we face with companies, and are they playing too big of a role, and what are people's views on that? It's all across the board how people view that. I do think that we're on a trajectory right now that my view is we'll take anything we can get as long as it's ethical from whomever it might be. It could be a high net worth donor. It could be a family foundation. It could be a university student. It could be volunteering. You know, I read the other day that Peace Corps has an 88-year-old volunteer woman who's volunteering. I think that's wonderful. And so we look at it very much on the micro and macro level. Now, at some point, do I hope that universal giving's model changes so that we're not doing philanthropy? You know, I used to say, you sometimes hear people say, well, I will succeed when I'm out of business. But at the end of the day, I actually don't think that's true because, you know, let's say that we get everyone to a higher level and standard of living, and we're already starting to see that. You know, about 10 years ago, we didn't have a middle class, and now we have a middle class that's in the developing nation that's earning $15 to $50 a day. That's huge. We were dealing with people before who were earning, you know, $2 a day, as we've heard that statistic a lot. And so now we have a middle class that has money to be able to spend on health, to spend it on education, to start thinking about voting rights, things that they couldn't think about before because they were starving. So you have this emerging nation middle class, which is going to become increasingly powerful. My hope is, yes, that they get into strong positions where they can donate back and they can be involved in the community and the governments can help as well. But I really believe it takes a multiple-pronged approach, and I believe it's going to take that for a long, long time. So I don't want to turn down any type of philanthropy unless it's ineffective. And I think that's when you have to look at a lot of existing organizations that are out there now, and a lot of them are really ineffective, and people working there will admit that. And so we are scrambling right now. People are trying to find more effective ways to do it because we've got billions of dollars going in ways that are not being effectively used. Some of those are governmental programs. Some of them are corporate programs. Some of them are large NGOs or political organizations. Any of them can be inefficient. We are looking, Universal Giving, to partner with the most efficient quality organizations just as we have that same standard as well. So I don't. My view is if you don't want to accept the funds from companies, don't accept them. Don't do it. You know, if you don't want to accept that, I really admire, I'm a big proponent of companies, the companies that are ethical and doing good work. I look at it and, you know, when we lambast companies, I say, hold on a second, do a little scan of all your good friends and your colleagues and find out how many of them are working at companies. You know, I read a statistic the other day saying about 40 to 45% of us in the past 18 months have either faced a reduction in hours or a reduction in pay. Well, imagine a whole bunch of these corporate jobs cut. I mean, it affects our economy, our health, our welfare state. And I think, you know, when you also look at this, when we look at the role, if you're saying, if one is saying that government is more benevolent or purer to handle these kind of help for the society, all I have to do is look at our current deficit and say, where's the money going to come from? Are we going to print more money? How are we going to do that? So, you know, I am very much of the mind of practical, where's the money coming from? We can't dump it all on the government. And I'm grateful for companies, for individual donors. I look at billionaires who are signing up on that pledge where they're giving away their money. And even if they're doing it for peer pressure, great. Wonderful. Let's get you in here and get you excited about giving away half your money. I think it's great. So I think it's all good as long as it's ethical.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and Pamela Holly and Bob Salvich, who are discussing the leading edge for corporate responsibility and social engagement. And our next questioner.
Hi, my name is Peter Gisella. I like your remarks about scale and efficiency, and I was curious about your experience at the White House meeting these 50 other people and to what degree you have observed or in a subjective manner looked at their efficiencies. And I believe I spoke to you about 6 years ago about my 30-year interest in a national youth service program that would challenge youth year after year to think about volunteering to do some kind of community service or military service, and about 50% of them would be doing it with nonprofits. But my question to you was about doing this through the internet and how do you set up a portal site. And I was guessing that the government would spend $25 to $50 million to set it up. And the person that told me had co-designed the volunteer net. So that's where I assume it was you, because I don't know who the other person was, said that with the right people, with the right trained people, you could do it for about $1 million. But my frustration is, as I come to events like this here at the Commonwealth and World Affairs Council and meet corporate CEOs, the chairman of Wells Fargo, got great photos with all these people, share the information with them, and never hear anything back. And so, you know, is this just lack of communication? where, you know, this whole concept is a beautiful strategy, but at this point, after 30 years, it's still a fantasy.
Well, actually, it's exciting. You know, we've got some global bills right now that are occurring, and it's very exciting. We have one that's already passed that is allowing not just students, but it's actually giving matching grants to people who want to volunteer abroad and giving them matching grants, and it's actually already active. And so that's very exciting to see, and that is open to students. And we're also seeing a global service bill from the senator of Wisconsin as well. And so we are seeing those global service bill and volunteer bills taking place. I'm not sure we need another portal or the government to create a portal. They don't have plans that I know of to do that at this time, because they do see other entrepreneurs and organizations such as Universal Giving providing that service and leveraging it. I mean, I think one of the things we look at is we don't mind being the behind-the-scenes engine. We are just kind of, we'll power by any site, powered by Universal Giving. You guys can be the front people, and we'll provide that back-end engine because we have that expertise in engineering and creating a website. And to be frank, I mean, you know, when I started Universal Giving, you know, for the first year and a half to create the site, it was $80,000. It all depends on how you want to spend your money. I posted on Craigslist, and I got an Australian engineer to help me build it, who was so motivated and so excited that he helped build it for free for the first 6 months before we started paying him. So I was working out of my home, and I think as entrepreneurs, you can be as scrappy as you like. And sometimes I'm wary of the fact when it says $5 million to build a website. I'm like, what are we building here? And, you know, I do think that, you know, it can justify it at times. It depends on how much social networking you're putting on there. And over time, does it take $5 million? Yes, of course it does. But when you're first starting out, you don't need that. And you can be very scrappy. We still have that same bootstrap mentality at Universal Giving today because it served us so well about using our resources effectively. We do have the global bills out, which is exciting. We just, when we were back in D.C., I also met with the senators and also with Barbara Boxer's office as well about these initiatives, and we're writing letters in support of these initiatives to help provide matching grants for workers and university students so that they can volunteer. So it is happening, and it is exciting to see. So I do see that positive trend happening.
Are you saying the Corporation for National Community Service website is no longer needed?
No, I think they're all needed. It's great. Volunteer Match, Universal Giving, Corporation for National Service. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, all of them are good. Yes.
My name is Brad Dacus. I'm an attorney from the Pacific Justice Institute. And we started a video project called Faith in the Workplace, where we talk about, it's just launched, educate business owners, corporations, on how they can not only do matching programs, but also get their employees to donate 1 or 2 or 3 days a month in projects, partnering with charities to serve the needy in their community and around. My office flew me up here to hear you speak, and now I know why. What can we do? We're giving out this information to these companies. Here's what you can do legally. What can we do to facilitate them? Because this is what you're involved in too, right? I mean, as far as getting the employees themselves, not just matching, but actually getting employees out, right?
Yes.
What do you recommend to groups like us and companies who are trying to get them to mobilize this? Who should we connect them with on the implementation side? We're doing the legal counsel side, but on the implementation side, would you advise, and would you guys do that?
Yes, we do that. Okay. So I think that's the quick answer, is that we're very, very practical on the ground entrepreneurs. So when we look at a company, we first want to make sure that their CSR strategy is in place. What are you trying to achieve? And that first goes across, what are you trying to do in giving? What are you trying to do in volunteering? What are you trying to do in product donation, sustainability, the environment? We go after all those categories. You as a company might decide to not be involved in some of those categories. So, for example, some companies, when you first start out, my recommendation would be to start with a volunteering, because the volunteering is easier to facilitate. And what happens is that with money, you have to be very careful. What system are you getting to track the money? Especially if you start to go into matching gifts. So let's take an overview here, a little bit of CSR when we take a look at this. You're dealing, first of all, with volunteer programs, volunteering domestically, volunteering internationally. When they're doing that, how are they signing up for this program? What software and what database are you using to do this? Do you want to have to track hours. So, for example, do you want to have the employees come and volunteer? How are you going to track the results? Because to be honest, we're not that excited about helping companies if they just want to do it, feel good, and they don't want to track results. What we do is we come in and we help companies with a platform and say, here's a way that you can help volunteer your time. We can report back 24/7 how many employees have volunteered, in what department they've volunteered, how many hours were given across the issues of environment, of healthcare, of education, how many hours were given across the area in Texas in education, in Ghana in the environment. So you can cross-section countries, cities, issue areas so that you can come back with results to your CEO. We're all about results to the CEO. And then if you're really smart about it, you're valuing the volunteer hour. Independent sector values it around $19 an hour. However, if you're doing more high-level work, such as an attorney, you might value that at $200 or whatever it might be. And so then you cost out those hours to go back and say, our company has donated X amount of hours. It could be 9 million hours, or it could be, let's say, for example, 2,000 hours valued at $200 an hour, and you're able to save back that monetary cost that you've devoted to the community. So we recommend going small, start with one program first, execute on it by establishing a track record, and then launching another program. Because I think that's, you know, you want to make sure that first is successful. One of the biggest challenges we see with companies, they set up programs, people don't use them. I remember with a company about 10 years ago, they had a phenomenal program, which was you could volunteer for one day a year, 8 hours a year. And only 3% of their employee workforce took advantage of it. There were two major reasons for that. One, it wasn't marketed out well, so the employees didn't know about it. And two, the managers were not receptive to it. So if your manager was not receptive to it and was looked down, you weren't likely going to go volunteer. So having the policies in place really has to have a lot of buy-in from the top part of the culture, medium, low, all across the board. So communication is critical. And that's what we also talked about too with Universal Giving Corporate, that when you have these policies internationally, imagine the challenges of marketing it when you're dealing with different languages, different cultures, and the fact that philanthropy means something very, very different in other countries. So for here, if you look at it, what do we think philanthropy is? We think it's money. But if you look at some of the things I've written on my blog, it's not. The definition of philanthropy is the love of humankind. And that can be translated into pretty much any other culture if you look at it. And it's very fascinating. There's a lot of research we've done about how that's translated into other cultures. So you have to really then look at marketing. When you look at marketing in the U.S., it's very different than how you would market it internationally. And my recommendation would be is that if you don't have international employees or if you don't plan on launching international, you still should. And there's key reasons for it why. Let's say you're a domestic company and you say, well, I don't have international employees. I don't have to worry about international. Why should you care? Well, number one, you've got a lot of employees that either their parents are first generation or they're first generation just coming to the United States. So they have a history of caring about other countries and wanting to give back to other countries, even if your employer doesn't work there. So your employees will feel so much more satiated if you're giving back to countries that they believe in or have a background with. Number two, crisis giving. Doesn't matter if you're not international. Crisis giving is a hot spot for everyone, and that's where we can come in and vet nonprofits and allow you to give to crises that allow your employees to feel a part of a larger community and a larger global community. So having the ability to give to crises and to give back to homelands is extremely important, whether you're international or not. So kind of going back to your original question, we always work with companies on making sure they've got a good plan in place, making sure they're the right tools to execute, and then making sure there's the right marketing and communications, because it is not build it and they'll come. I am writing a book right now, but it's not yet, but you can check out my blog. It's Living and Giving, and I'm Pamela Hawley. So yes.
Who has the mic? There you go.
Hi, Jeremy Kenton. I'm a scrappy entrepreneur. It seems like a lot of brands and companies are scared about talking about CSR, even if they're doing great things, that they're scared of sticking their neck out because they're so protective of their brands and they don't want to be criticized. Like even a company that's doing great things in Africa, maybe they don't want to talk about it because they're scared that a group of people might say, why are you doing things in Africa? You should be doing things in the U.S. Mm. So what advice would you give those companies?
You know, that is a very, very tough question because we do get a lot of pushback of people saying there's a lot of needs here in the U.S., and there are. There are a lot of needs here, and we do need to be responsive and responsible to them. At the same time, I've found something in life, and this is very much what my dear parents have taught me, is to really go after your passion in life. And if you're really passionate about India, or if you're passionate about working with kids in your backyard in East Palo Alto, or if you're passionate about working at your kid's school, or if you're passionate about, I was, going to Cambodia and working with victims from Pol Pot's regime, then I sincerely believe you should go do that. And I think that's the most important thing, is to go after your passion, because you will be the most effective in helping other people by really going after what you love to do and shining in that endeavor. So I think that would be my counsel. I do think there's a lot of pushback about giving internationally, because people do feel a lot of challenges that we face here. I personally am very, very wedded to international, but this year I just started giving a ton more to domestic, just personally myself and philanthropy, because I was like, I'm not going to let this economy beat our nonprofits. I'm not going to do it. So I just upped giving to 30 different nonprofits, because I just probably shouldn't say this on the radio, right? but the point being is that I don't want this economy to beat nonprofits. And so I care about them, and they're struggling, and we need to help. So on companies, we do need to be careful about their brand. It is rough for them out there sometimes. You know, it's not easy for them. And if there's a PR debacle, it can cost them millions to turn that around. Especially, let's say it's even false. Doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's still about perception, and people still remember that. So I understand why that happens, and also because it's what we've talked about with media vetting, that the communication is so important, that you're allying yourselves with top-notch quality organizations and leaders on the ground wherever you're going. And that's what universal giving focuses on. It's not just about doing good. Who are you doing it with? And it's got to be with quality. We have to have a plan in place. We have to know what our objectives are. We have to vet the NGOs. We have to market it out and make sure your employees and the nonprofits know about it. And we have to gradually and gently and step by step and proactively increase this buy-in that your company has over long term. And I think one thing we haven't talked about tonight is this is all long term. I mean, this is all about long term building. There is no quick shot here. There is no quick PR turnaround. I don't believe that in life either. There is nothing that's short-term. Anything that you build of value is a long-term endeavor that you are working hard and diligently with very, very strong values. And so we have to understand that some companies, they don't know what's going to come at them, especially on the international front.
There's a microphone right here.
I got it. Thank you so much for being here tonight, Pamela. As a fellow CSR professional, one of the criticisms I constantly have to answer is the question I get is,
nice.
Well, I think that businesses are only doing it because, you know, it has value for them for a business reason, and they're just greenwashing. And so I know how I usually answer that when I hear that criticism, but I was wondering how you answer that.
Well, we do love motives. Good motives win the day. They just do, right? And I think when you work with a company, you can see that when you walk in and you can look at someone's eyes. I will say that whether we are hiring people at Universal Giving, whether we're vetting NGOs, whatever it might be, you know, we look less at what people are saying and we look right into their eyes and really get a strong sense of values and motives. So we want to work with the best as far as motives and what people are striving to do, because those values are what are going to last for the long term. Having said that, as I mentioned earlier, there are some CEOs we've worked with who said, gosh, I guess I kind of got to do this. What do I need to do? Pamela, help me, you know, help me have a good program here that will help me with employee retention, attract the Y generation, you know, help sell my product. And I will say, yes, we will help you do that. And at the same time, not exclusive, we will also help you do good, and you will be able to do both, and you are doing both. And I think the best thing you can do is to get those CEOs or senior VPs volunteering on the ground, or if they can't do it because they're too busy, getting testimonials from the employees that say how much they valued it, or from the nonprofits. Because CEOs face such challenges every day to get some positive feedback. People don't really realize that with CEOs. They just think, you know, you've got Teflon. And so all of a sudden you get some positive feedback as a CEO. You're like, oh my goodness, this is exciting. Not rather than just facing the challenges all the time. I think you have to be able to give that good feedback to the CEOs. And I have seen their eyes change from, I guess I have to do this, to, wow, This is powerful. I'm helping someone. And I think this is important. We always look at scaling because scaling is very, very important in our world. But it also comes down to the micro. If you can just affect one other person. And that is really important. Now, one of the things that's really helping us, which I think is really good, is we're starting to see leadership positions change to get higher and higher up with the titles. When I was first starting out, community relations was sometimes, let's say you might have been a school teacher and you decided to make a job change. Or you might have been, you know, a lot of different things and you just kind of moved over to community relations. But what's changed now is that you have VP of marketing and corporate social responsibility. Or you have COO and sustainability expert. And so you're seeing high-level people have these titles. And I think where we can influence that, that's very, very important. So they start thinking about that in their day-to-day. And it rubs off on you. So we always counsel companies, it is not exclusive, it's an and. Yes, we will help you with your business bottom line, and we're also going to help do good for the community. So we focus on both of that.
Hi, Pamela. I work for a Fortune 50 company and as well as volunteer for a nonprofit organization that does projects around the world. Personally, I've been involved in projects in Cambodia and India, Bangladesh, Ethiopia, several countries. And what I wonder is how are organizations getting involved with volunteer service organizations? Like one of the projects that we're working on right now is eradicating polio. And, you know, a lot of times we will have hundreds of thousands of volunteers that will mobilize within for a National Immunization Day like in India. But we have projects in 180 countries currently. How do we get companies to pay more attention to, or how do we get companies interested in volunteer organizations that are doing these projects where all they need is sort of the material and the help on the ground, especially when, you know, when you might have 300 or 400 projects going on at any one time?
So let me make sure I understand that. So how do you get the companies involved in helping the organizations mobilize volunteers or get the companies interested to help your particular nonprofit? Or
it seems to be that companies would prefer to pay, would prefer to support NGOs that are actually doing the work that might have coordinated paid staff in a lot of areas, where a lot of times the projects that we do, we get companies to donate like a well, and then we get volunteers to actually go and insert and put the well together. Or like with National Immunization Days, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation gave us $555 million to actually buy the vaccine so that we could then have the volunteers administer the vaccine on their own dime.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of trying to get corporations to be interested in a lot of these projects, or if their people and money are interested, getting them involved in a project that may not necessarily be an established NGO, mm-hmm. something that may have been part of Rotary International,
mm-hmm.
Or a club project, but not necessarily an established NGO?
Mm-hmm. That is a very, very challenging question because you can imagine companies, you know, I think most entrepreneurs look at this. You don't normally start two entrepreneurial ventures at once. If you do, something's not going to take off. And if you're starting a CSR program or if you're trying to expand it and you're trying to work with organizations that are run off of volunteer base and that's the primary focus, that is challenging because companies are looking for stability. My recommendation would be is you need to have a very, very strong tool in place that can track the volunteers and make sure that you've got them mobilized in advance. So when you get a company or when you're approaching a company, you're saying, here's the tool that we're using. We can mobilize these volunteers and assure them that there is that security that you can effectively operationalize, recruit volunteers, mobilize them, and track results for the companies. So if you can do that operationally and show that effectiveness and prove it, then I think you have a strong shot at it. If you don't show them that, you know, I've already recruited this successfully, even on a small scale of mobilizing 20 volunteers, then that's tough. And I do think it takes some kind of software or database or application that you're managing them and showing the companies that you're managing and mobilizing volunteers because you've got shifting staff. You've got shifting staff. And is that staff local? Because you'll need some local in order to get the buy-in. So you'll need to show the companies that you've got local buy-in by local people. Are there communications issues, language issues? And then you've also got to demonstrate the proficiency side, which is who knows how to build the well. Hopefully it's some people who are local. We need that. It can't be all people coming from outside. But you might need some people coming from outside. And so that mobilization tool is going to be incredibly important. If I were a company and a CEO, I'd be like, great, show me that you've successfully mobilized 50 volunteers before I'm willing to start moving some of the product of the $550 million from the Gates Foundation to come in and mobilize, you know, 100,000 volunteers. So you need to show that successful track record, and I would show them the volunteer database to show them the people who've signed up and done a successful project on a smaller scale. Now, as far as how to attract companies, we know that companies' top issues are health, education, and children. Now, a lot of them, other ones cover environment, and there's a lot of other ones that are up and coming, but those are the top three. Well, you've definitely hit it with vaccinations and health, so you're in a good spot. And I think the key is, operationally, that would be my warning sign as a CEO of how are they going to make this happen? Not that you can't, but you've got to go a step further to show them you put those precautions in place.
You have a question?
Yeah. Great, thank you. I would just love your top tip of advice. I work for an international nonprofit that has a very lean team here in the U.S., and historically they've never worked in corporate partnerships. And some local advice, what would be your top tip in Silicon Valley, how to break in, particularly because we're not in those big sections, we're not education, health, or environment.
Mm-hmm.
It's humanitarian landmine clearance, and you know, we need money where governments have historically given us the bulk of our money, and they still do, but there's cutbacks, and we need more private donors.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, congratulations on diversifying your source, because that's important, yeah. And it is exciting, and you will definitely be able to do it. What I would do, and this is kind of, I think it's a neat area to look into, is look at, there are definitely companies that are more or less innovative and willing to kind of go into some different areas. Look for the companies that maybe aren't funding the top three. Look at companies that maybe have funded some different initiatives. And definitely look at what we talked about before, passion and motivation. What does the CEO really believe in? What is the VP of CSR? Do they have a heart for handicapped children, for environmental issues, for landmines? I mean, there are definitely companies out there that want to distinguish themselves. But when you think about breaking in, instead, I'd change your language and I'd say, how can we help serve the company to help them with a need? And if you start to change that language, what will happen is when you're looking at companies, you'll think less of how can I get this partnership, how can I get this from them, and more, oh, we can position you as an innovator. We've seen you be an innovator in this area before. Landmines is very near to where your product is being sold. This is something that is affecting people. I saw this in Cambodia. I mean, 70% of the people I worked with had some portion of their limbs were gone from landmines. And so their workforce largely was doing a lot of technical work on computers because often they couldn't do other manual labor. So if companies are starting to go into more areas like that, then and it affects their workforce, boy, then you just hit the company's bottom line. These are people who might be potential employees for you in the future. And if you donate to us, we're helping rehabilitate them. We're helping prevent it so that people are not getting their limbs blown off, for lack of a better word. My apologies. But the point is that talk from the company's viewpoint. How will this help them? And you're not trying to break in. You're trying to help them with their bottom line. And maybe there's a place where either one, it hits the heart or motive of a senior executive or someone from the foundation or community relations. And number two, also hits the bottom line of maybe potential workforce members. So in line with that, one thing, too, I just want to bring up briefly is that we've seen a whole explosion of where the right people are within the company. It could be anyone. Companies are listening more to employees. So in the past, it was community relations and the foundations. Now corporate communications is involved. HR is starting to get involved. VPs are involved. Marketing is involved. So there's a lot of different points you can go in, not just from community relations and foundations. Go to what helps their bottom line. Go to their passion.
Unfortunately, we've reached that moment in our program, which we hate to reach when it's been so interesting and wonderful. For one last question and discussion from you and Bob. So we will start with a question and refer that to you.
Question. Hey, Pamela. Great presentation. Just have a quick question in regards to the bottom line. You've mentioned it several times. Regarding the bottom line, are you referring to public companies or private companies? And if they're public companies, how have the programs ensured any success with the bottom line? How is it? Have you had a chance to look at any trends, put some numbers behind the phrase? And also, what type of companies are really interested in that? What is the bottom line? Is the bottom line employee retention? Is it earnings? Is it breaking to market? And how that has improved with any of the corporate responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Bottom line is translated in many, many different ways. It can be a triple bottom line. It can be environmental regulations. It can be for-profit monetary bottom line. It can be product adoption. There are many ways to define what that bottom line is. I think Cisco has provided a very strong example with their Cisco networking academies. For example, they have used that to train people technically and help them get technical skills, whereby they have then been able to train and perform and prepare developing nations' workforce for the Cisco workforce. That is definitely affects their bottom line because they are setting up a benevolent program where they are training people with skills and then using it to help recruit for their new employee workforce. So that's one way that the bottom line would be affected. Another way I know too, for example, is Intel. They've gone in and donated computers and chips into schools. They're educating kids. It's helping the kids get educated. And at the same time, they are getting in sales of their products into schools. So that also helps their bottom line and is benevolent as well. And education is so important in developing nations. And then I think also what we talked about earlier was with Symantec. They're going into the continent of Africa, and they don't even have operations there yet. And so they are expecting that that will help their bottom line in the future. And maybe that is purely from a perspective of global brand, that they believe that will help their image enough to help with product as well. That may not be as strong a one, but that certainly does affect bottom line as well. So that we are seeing more of a trend that way. I definitely know it's 97% of Y generation says a company has to do good, or they don't even want to interview. And so we know that you know, affecting bottom line and keeping people from Y generation and keeping your employee retention rate is incredibly important. Having said that, sure, it's challenging to measure exactly why someone is staying at a company. You know, is it the benefits? Is it daycare? Is it the salary? Is it the volunteer program? Is it the matching gifts? All of that, you have to take all those factors into consideration. But in closing, I would just say I think we have a whole new landscape in corporate social responsibility. It is definitely embedded in our landscape and our culture now. It's not really a possibility. Most companies are doing it, whether they're public or private companies. And I always like to point to companies like GE, who are an absolute innovator, that in 1910, their board of directors set up a volunteer program not only for their employees, but also for their retirees, to say you're an important part of a community. We will continue to support you volunteering even when you don't work here anymore. That's very, very powerful trend, 1910. And so we have to honor companies like that who are total innovators, buy a board like that, and be grateful that as we move forward, this trend is here to stay, both from the perspective of bottom lines and from the perspective of doing good.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. We've had the privilege of listening to Pamela Hawley, founder and CEO of Universal Giving, the title of her talk, The Leading Edge for Corporate Social Responsibility. Our thanks to you and to all the folks listening on the radio. Thank you, Pamela. You've been a great contributor. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Ann Clark, and I want to thank Bob and Pamela for coming. For those of you who came locally and flew up, come locally again and fly up anytime you wish. We were delighted to have you. And we do thank you for joining us and celebrating with us 107 years of enlightened discussion. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.